Welcome to the first episode of The First Thing We Do Is Kill All the Lawyers. And it's an often misquoted Shakespeare quote, but it's funny, you know, lawyers have spun that to try to say, no, it's actually a positive thing about lawyers. Well, it wasn't. If you look at it, when Shakespeare wrote it in 1598, he was taking shots at lawyers. And and that's something that has gone on since. So that's one of the reasons I figured I'd start this broadcast. I'm David Heffernan. I've been practicing personal injury law here in South Florida for close to 30 years. I'm also an adjunct faculty over at the University of Miami, and I practice with a good friend of mine and my partner from law school under the firm of Karen Heffernan. And the goal behind putting this whole broadcast together was to bring other lawyers in. So figure out maybe we shouldn't kill all of them, but maybe just a few, because there are some out there still.
Or most of them.
Most of them. But there's a few that haven't. And to bring other lawyers in, talk about different aspects of law, types of law, all across the board, various types, maybe some trending topics in law to get into what's going on, and maybe educate the people that listen about when they might need a lawyer, when they won't, some things they might be able to do on their own. And my first guest was an easy choice. He's a good friend. He's a great lawyer. I've had cases against him. I've had cases with him. I've consulted on cases with him. And he's also one of the few lawyers that I actually see eye to eye with. And that's not philosophical or anything else. It's just because he's about 6'5". So
true.
My good friend, Jim Nosich, founding partner of the law firm Nosich & Gans. Jim, how are you?
Great, Dave. Good morning.
Good morning.
Everything's fantastic.
All right. So you and I have a lot of similarities because I know you've also been practicing in South Florida for just about 30 years, but you're not a South Florida guy. So tell me how a kid from Chicago winds up at the University of Miami.
Very easy. 1978 and 79 were the major blizzards in Chicago. So I came to the University of Miami, suntan unit at the time, but I picked up two majors, one in geology and one in marine science. And eventually that developed into going to law school and studying more in terms of the medicine, because I was pretty good at science and ended up in medical malpractice for the last 30 years.
So we got to talk about that because we do share some things. So you took geology. I took a course called Rocks for Jocks. I think it was similar.
Very similar.
But I also, it's funny because I started out, I wanted to go into marine science and I got recruited and went there to play football, obviously. And one of the things I rapidly learned that studying marine science and trying to practice and play football under Coach Snellenberger was a little difficult to do. So I was about one semester into marine science when I decided to switch to communications.
Well, it was way more difficult than I thought it would ever be. Everybody likes marine biology. You think you're going to be doing a lot of stuff in the ocean, but there's a lot of math and science behind it and a lot of work behind it and some good field camps and field studies, but mostly a lot of hard work, which eventually I had to do a field camp. I picked in terms of geology, I went to the mountains, the Blue Ridge Mountains. And they told me how to climb this giant mountain to go click on a rock with a hammer. And I go, yeah, this isn't for me. So I pulled out of that and ended up at Liberty Mutual Insurance Company in their safety consultant department and went to law school at night at the University of Miami and then developed into personal injury and mostly medical malpractice.
So you climbed mountains, you went into the ocean, and that drove you into the practice of law.
It drove me into the practice of law. It doesn't sound that miserable, but it apparently was that miserable.
Might be if it got into the practice of law.
100% agree. 100% agree.
All right. Well, let's talk about your practice because you did really, and you have over the last 30 years, carved out a niche of being somebody who really understands the nuances and the technicalities. Medical malpractice is a whole different animal in and of itself. So what was the appeal there and kind of how did that whole practice develop?
Sure. And as you know, because you're in that small little clique of medical malpractice lawyers, it's a highly specialized area. There's a small group of highly specialized lawyers doing it. I think what happened was I started with a firm. We started doing medical malpractice. It was on the defense side. And my partner and I, or my boss at the time, broke off. And that was almost 27 years ago, and we've had our own law firm since that time, doing representing doctors and hospitals. My current partner, Mark Gans, joined us about 20 years ago, and the older partner retired, and Mark and I kept the thing going. But about 2 years ago, we decided to move over to representing the patients. We think we're a benefit to the patients since we know everything on the defense side. And we try to take only those cases that have a lot of merit. As you know, they're very tough to prosecute, and in case selection, you want to make sure you have a client that has been wrongly injured and has significant damages, and try to resolve those cases for them.
So we throw the phrase back and forth, medical malpractice and everything else, but put it in layman's terms. What does it mean? You know, because we get calls a lot of times, and I always try to distinguish mm-hmm. to people, because there's bad medicine mm-hmm. and that happens. And sometimes, mm-hmm. sometimes people are just angry. It's a lack of communication or other things. Mm-hmm. But what rises to the level mm-hmm. of a medical malpractice case?
Well, first, I think it's interesting because I think a lot of lack of communication is what causes a lot of the problems with patients and their frustration. On the defense side, I've been involved in probably representing thousands of doctors. I've been in 1,000 conferences on it, and everybody tries to preach communication, and there's examples where, you know, patients would understand better that bad things can happen without anybody doing anything wrong if there was better communication. But there's a lot of bad communication. So the way I like to explain it is sort of like an auto accident or running a stop sign. So if a doctor runs a stop sign in the middle of the night and doesn't hit anybody in the intersection, there's no damage to anything. There's no harm. There's no causation. And therefore, there's no case. If you run the stop sign and you hit a car and you cause damages and it's your fault, then there's a medical malpractice case. And what we need to do is have the case looked at very thoroughly by medical experts to determine if the doctor acted inappropriately and that action caused the damage, and that damage is related to that inappropriate action. So it's kind of complicated, but maybe not so complicated, but it's hard to get all three elements in a medical malpractice case.
And I often explain that to clients is and that difference, because there's a whole legal scheme in medical malpractice cases. If you come to my office and you've been in a car accident, I can file a lawsuit today, mm-hmm. you know, but when it happens there, you've got to obtain records. You've got to get an expert affidavit all well before you ever can even be in a position to file a lawsuit.
Sure. I read probably minimum, and my partner separately, about 1,000 pages of medical records a week, probably up to 5,000 pages of medical records a week, going through each page, looking for the issues before even sending it out to a medical expert. So that takes a lot of experience to know what to look for before wasting anybody's time or looking for the appropriate expert to review the case. And as we all know, the term expert probably over the last 20, 25 years is kind of, to me at least, wishy-washy. I mean, only 40 years ago, doctors were recommending that women smoke Camels versus Kools, right. And they were called a medical expert. So you have to find the right expert, the expert that's smart and is not going to tell you what you want to hear, because the relationship with the client, if you take the case, you're talking 2, 3, 4 years. And like I always say, sometimes to my clients, I say, I might be one of your kids in the future's godfather, because you're going to know me so much. Right. You're going to talk so much. We're going to have a lot of communication, and we're going to build a good relationship.
All right. Let's shift a little bit, because we've been through a year like no other and are continuing through that year. Yeah. And I will point out, since we are close together in the studios, we have both been vaccinated.
Double vaccinated.
So it's all good as we're heading in that direction. But let's talk about it, because obviously every business everywhere has mm-hmm. been impacted in one way or the other as a result of the pandemic.
Yeah.
The legal field, clearly impacted. Courthouses shut down. They're gradually starting to reopen. I know you were part of a task force mm-hmm. that was put together here in Miami-Dade County. Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit about that. And let's talk about how the courts have tried to adjust and where we're going with this.
Sure. I was involved with the task force dealing with Dade County, the Dade County Courthouse and judicial system on the criminal and the civil side. A good friend of mine, Stuart Ratson, who's a well-known lawyer in Miami, was former classmate of yours. That's right. Was selected because of his perseverance and his ability to manage. Selected by the chief judge to put this task force together, and it contained medical expert specialists from the University of Miami on infectious disease and epidemiology, the high-end administrative trial judges, also government officials and lawyers and constitutional lawyers, civil lawyers, criminal defense lawyers, a good solid scope to study what was happening. I think we put that into place back in probably June of last year to try to get something going because the judicial system stopped. And that's very tragic. It's very tragic to have it stop and pause even.
Absolutely. And I will tell you, I give a lot of credit. I mean, people I use serve on the task force, but our judiciary, because again, as with everything, really was able to pivot pretty quickly while the courthouses were closed. You know, all of these things that weren't in our vocabulary before, yeah. You know, Zoom meetings and everything else. But they've done a great job of continuing best that they can to move cases with Zoom hearings.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, I think a lot has to be given to them credit wise.
Yeah.
For what they've done. But obviously, you've got to have courtrooms open for things like jury
yeah.
trials.
Yeah.
And you got to have people there. So they've started gradually. So what's the process now? I know jury trials are back. I haven't been in one yet, but they're back. My wife's actually got jury duty next week. So it'll be yeah. interesting.
So Judge Bailey and Judge Soto, the two top administrative judges in Dade County, probably got their team of a lot of judges in Dade County working on Zoom with hearings. They were doing the most of any county in the United States. So they got on board quickly. A lot of counties were around the United States, more old fashioned or not set up electronically or didn't have the motivation. Maybe they thought the COVID would pass, but we were on board right away. And the hearings help, but no jury trials and criminal, which we try to handle first, even though the civil trials are important, but people are in jail waiting right. for their trial dates. So we try to get
a lot more constitutional rights to be able to get yeah. in front of a jury with
but
a criminal
on
trial.
The other hand, if someone like me represent a client who is dying of cancer that was improperly diagnosed, that if diagnosed earlier, they wouldn't be in this predicament. And you want to get them a trial day and you want them to see justice before they pass and have their family enjoy seeing their loved one have justice before they pass. And so now we're just starting jury trials. We tried everything in the book. We tried virtual with potential jurors on video or on Zoom. And then we tried everything off online, and then we started bringing some people in. And I think what's going to happen is the only way to get it back really is once we get through this pandemic and get everybody back as close as to normal, because everybody's really got to be there. Jury selection, the lawyers want to see the jurors want to see the lawyers and the parties. We're starting in that direction. There's jury trials, but very few. So if right. your wife got the jury selection notice, they're now starting to go out. But again, it's limited. There's only going to be a couple courtrooms
right.
in the whole courthouse. And there's about a backlog of several thousand cases waiting for a jury trial, plus all the new cases. So that's the predicament we're in right now.
So if you took out the crystal ball,
I mean, yeah.
and assuming we're, and it's a big assumption that we continue the course we're on, yeah. that we're sort of over the hump on this. And like I said, that's a big assumption because I don't know that we're out of the woods by any stretch, but assume we can get back to whatever normal is. I mean, how long do you think that backlog in the courts is going to affect trial lawyers and clients and everything else?
I say, this is just my opinion,
right?
about 3 years or so, only because, or maybe more, because I look back on Hurricane Andrew, and that shut the whole system down here, and for years, even 5 and 6 years, lawyers were still filing continuances and things because their offices were destroyed, right, and they were shut down and they couldn't get back together. But I think what's going to have to happen is, once jury trials pick up, once they pick up, a lot of cases will then start to resolve because of the pressure of trial on both sides, resolving meaning a settlement. And once you have that, some of the cases are going to start to close. There'll always be new ones, but then we'll start to be able to try cases and get it back in order. But I think we're 3 years before normalness, even if we kind of started today.
Right. Well, and that's an interesting point comparing it to Andrew, because two disasters, but two totally different. You're right.
Yeah.
Lawyers, I mean, downtown, you know, lost, and back then paper files were everything, you know, pretty much lost everything. Here, at least with practices, you could continue the practice with the exception of, you know, jury trials and key evidentiary hearings, I think. But again, credit to the lawyers in South Florida to be able to adapt, you know, start working from home, at least be able to continue to move cases to some degree. And again, I think a lot of credit to the judges, because at least I found, you know, certain judges really embraced it.
Yeah.
And they had some more time on their hands.
Yeah.
I've never had so many case management conferences.
Yes.
And they were just case management conferences. Go, what are you doing to move your case? And that's needed. I mean, you know, to really push these lawyers, because we are past the point of saying, you know, I need a continuous for this and that. I mean, cases need to be certified trial ready now.
Yeah, that's a good point. So we tried a lot of things, and the judges tried a lot of things, like non-binding arbitrations, which is kind of a mini trial in front of an arbitrator to then decide based on what he hears in the argument, is there any fault, and how much money should be exchanged or settled. But it's, like I said, non-binding, so it was only a suggestion. It doesn't really have too much of a bite, but we were really, really trying to close files, because the only way we're ever going to move ahead is to close the existing pending case law. And judges are looked at, or one of the things they're evaluated on is closing cases. Not that they're just trying to close cases, but there's only so many judges. There's a lot of cases, state, county, criminal and civil, and you got to get the process closed because there's new cases every day. They're being evaluated on that. They're doing a fantastic job in Dade County. Broward is starting up very soon. They have a very strong and powerful administrative judge up there, Judge Tudor. And West Palm Beach is already starting to try cases. A little bit more laxed up in the Palm Beach area and north of that area. In Jacksonville, they're trying it. But Dade County, I think, is really, under the circumstances of our makeup down here, doing probably the best job they can to get the system rolling.
Yeah, I think you got to give a lot of credit. And I watched early on, it was Brandon Watson, some other lawyers I knew did that experimental trial.
Yes.
You know, again, for jury selection of having 40 little boxes and trying to engage people, I just don't see how that ever works.
Well, I think because we feel as trial lawyers that we're so great,
right,
and everybody wants to watch us. Yeah, we want to be watched. So we want to be there, but I think it's very important for the lawyers to watch the jurors every second. That's what we do. We're trained observers of the entire courtroom, looking at the judge's face, the jurors' faces, opposing parties' faces, opposing attorneys' faces, and we're gathering information, probably wrongly, who knows, but that's what we do for a living, and we try to use all that to our advantage to help our client.
That's when you figure out juror number six. It wasn't that he didn't like your case. He just had indigestion from what he had at lunch. But that face, you're like, oh, we're in trouble now. You know?
Right, right. Or he wasn't sleeping because you were being totally boring. He was just very tired.
Right.
But that's the things that happens. And I think the way our system is, and it's one of a kind in the world, with our Seventh Amendment and the right to jury trial, is that it's kind of set up where everybody should be in the room. You should be able to confront your the witnesses against you. You should be able to look that jury in the eye. It's going to make a decision on your case. And I think that's the best way. But we're trying, even though we can't do that part right now, we still got to move through the cases, or we're never going to have justice at the end of the day in the way we thought was best, having everybody together in one room.
100%. And those issues, because you mentioned on that task force of constitutional lawyers, was just in, I guess, the other day. And it's Joseph DiMaria, who's a friend of mine, you know, has now raised an issue and trying to take it up on appeal because he doesn't want a witness to testify with a mask on. Yeah. Because, again, and you think about it, the way we see each other now, and you wear masks, but you can't, you know, you can only read so much from somebody's eyes.
Right. And a judge in the courthouse, Dade County Courthouse, goes, all right, well, we're going to wear the clear plastic mask, but they start steaming up.
Right.
So you can't, we're trying the best we can, but I see the point. You want to see the facial expressions. We're trained to read the demeanor of a person, like a lie detector test, based on what they look like in their body motions. The other thing was, when the constitutional lawyers raised in the task force, what kind of jurors are we going to get during the pandemic? If we start sending out the notice, we're going to be filtering through people, different categories of people based on their thought in their mind that they can go into the courthouse and be safe, versus people that are just as qualified, just want to stay home because they believe being safe is there. And does that give you a fair trial because you want a cross section of all the jurors, potential jurors in Dade County to pick from? And then for medical malpractice cases, well, we were used to having 100 jurors come in to select right. from. You select 6 out of 100, and that might sound like a lot, but a lot of people have opinions
very
on
strong
medical
opinions,
very
right?
strong, and those people shouldn't sit on a trial with strong opinions. So you end up almost always like with only a couple extra out of 100. So now we're like bringing 24 in or 28 people in to pick from, and that's the way it has to be if you want to get your case moving, shut down, and help your client out.
Yeah, but the problem with that is trying to get 6 out of that 28 that both sides agree on, and, you know, I'm not going to say defense lawyers or anything else, but, you know, it's an easy way to get this to continue to roll over when
sure.
you can't get 6 jurors.
Sure. Everybody wants, each side wants the jurors who they think is their non-biased.
Jury of our peers, as long as they agree with me.
Yeah, 100%. Same definition as justice.
Right.
But if that's what it takes to get through this one-of-a-kind situation, we're going to have to just dig through it and get through that.
I think it's been tremendous, and you know it firsthand, but again, credits to Judge Soto and Judge Bailey and all of the Dade County judges, because we do get to look a little wider in the state of Florida as to what's going on. And I think Dade County has been a front runner from trying the virtual trials, yeah. you know, on an experimental basis, to trying in person, but, you know, jurors are sitting 6 feet apart, you know, you don't hand them any documents. They've got all of the exhibits ahead of time. I mean, but trying every single aspect of it to get back to where we can function as a courthouse again.
All right, kind of prevents you from doing your old trick of showing the document at the last second.
Right.
Because you got it. Well, actually, now you have to pre-mark everything. You have to give everything way in advance. It's really not, I'm just joking with you, we're not supposed to have any surprises. But again, that's taking all these things, take the edge off the more clever lawyer or the more sophisticated lawyer. But again, we got to just dig in and do it, or we're never going to get out of this mess.
Yeah, but see, I've always wanted, you watch all the Law and Order shows and everything else.
Yes.
Have you ever had a motion in your pocket? Because you ever notice there's a debate, oh, that's never coming in. Well, here's our motion to suppress. So I've got to figure out a way I can just start carrying some motions in my pocket.
I've never had it, but I've had, and I thought it was very strange that coincidentally they pulled something out when they're arguing to the judge, when I had no clue that they were going to do that. So I was always thought it was a little fishy
right.
when that happens. But no, I've never been able to do that. I wish I could.
Yeah. Well, and I also learned, I grew up down the street from J.B. Spence, who was a yeah. phenomenal, storied trial attorney. But I learned from him early on, and it's harder to do on Zoom, because when he'd see a juror start to nod off, he'd knock a book off of his off of his table. Oh, sorry. You know,
yeah. just,
that way you don't embarrass the jury.
Yeah.
But you wake them up.
Yeah. And it's funny because we think we're the most interesting people. We're telling the most interesting story. And then you're like, oh, why are you paying attention? I'm so interesting. I'm so good at what I'm doing. But that also helps you hone your skill on maybe you have to change up something or move bob and weave and change up your story if everybody's not paying attention.
Well, I teach the students because I teach over in the trial program. And so this Saturday we'll actually have final trials, which I've done the last few all via Zoom, but we do have jurors come in, and it is interesting because no, it won't replace it, but they are engaged. Now these are a little different because these are students generally mm-hmm. that are in either Miami-Dade or in mm-hmm. high school that are interested in learning about law. So they're very engaged. But it just, you know, you can't replace it with that. But one of the things I tell them is, you know, we all think we're great, like you said, but you've done enough. I've done enough. You know, you do these mock trials where you've got, you know, five different jury pools that they split out, and then you start watching on camera and you're like, okay, they got it. They didn't like, you know, but
yeah.
no, they got what I wanted them to get, but the rest didn't. And it's just amazing to watch. But that's what's beautiful about the jury system
yeah.
is, and I tell these students, I go, look, you know, you should always, you know, there's three trials. There's the one you prepared for. There's the one that you actually conducted. And then there's the one you should have conducted.
Yeah.
But you can't change too much, because if you change out those six people, it's a whole different scenario.
A whole new game every single time. And I always wish that there would be the ability to always speak to the jurors after every jury trial. And what the judge does, goes, you can speak to the lawyers or not speak to the lawyers. Most of them just want to get out of there. They want
right.
to go home. Again, we think we're great. We want to hear. They just want to get out of there. Sometimes they speak to you. And I've gotten fabulous commentary and critique and compliments and everything that was very helpful. But, geez, that only happens not too often. And I wish that was something that we can do. But you can do mock trials, and where you get, like you're saying, you get jurors together and present your case, and then you can talk to them afterwards. Focus groups, we call them too, where you run your case by them, and you can get hopefully what they're thinking. But again, it all depends on the six jurors that are
right.
in the box at the time, because it's a different makeup every time.
Well, that's one of the things with the students. And so the final trials we do, and I think it's one of the most beneficial things for them, is because the juries deliberate in front of them, whether we do it in the courthouse mm. or whether we do it via Zoom. Mm. And I tell the students, I said, listen, it's the only chance you're going to ever get to mm. do this. And it's hard sometimes because they finish. And again, they've just gotten through a trial. All they want to do is, you know, I want to go have beer, leave uh-huh. me alone. But it is amazing, the feedback. And from subtle things, you find habits that you didn't realize, you know, you jiggle your keys or, you know, things like that. But then there's also some just really good content, and you hear it from the jurors. And I tell the students, I said, look, take note of that, because it's invaluable, and yeah. you don't get to do it in the real world.
Never get to do that. And it's always interesting on how the jury interprets the law that we see as black and white, because we do it so much day in and day out. And then you'll hear stories where they might want to give a verdict, but then they go, well, we have to calculate in the attorney's fee, which you're not supposed to
right.
do that. But everybody's somewhat familiar with how at least civil stuff works. But you got to just keep instructing them not to do it. But it's interesting to always know that that could happen in your jury room. And you have to look for a strong four person who's going to lead the jury and try to pick that person ahead of time. But then again, you're probably wrong 9 out of 10 times when you think who's going to be the foreman, when you've done the bet at the end, who's
right.
going to be the foreman, and it's the least likely person. You're like, everybody's going, what?
Yeah, exactly.
So that's always interesting
yeah,
too.
It's always fun. Yeah. If you reach the verdict, that one stands up, you're like, that's not supposed to be the four
yeah,
person.
That's not, it's not the four person. It can't
not,
be.
Not a good sign.
The
at
most
all.
Timid, shy, person that you thought was timid and shy was probably yelling in the
vocal
background.
Yeah. So. Yeah. It's always interesting, and it is, while a flawed, I agree with you. I think it's the greatest system in the world for both criminal and mm-hmm. civil. So let's talk pandemic a little bit.
Sure.
On your practice. I mean, mm-hmm. how has it affected you, and what do you see as things that have come out of this that will continue?
Well, I don't like the new recent law that was signed in Florida that gives immunity to a lot of different people. My major concern, part of that is medical. So on the other hand, I fully understand that in the midst of the pandemic, when everybody was overwhelmed and in the healthcare industry, it's hard to hold them to the normal standard of care in that situation. And I believe there should be some type of immunity for that. But I think the law that's in place has been too broad, because if you're in there in the hospital for an appendicitis and the hospital wasn't busy because it was one of those down periods, but there's still quote unquote COVID around in the hospital, more likely than not that those healthcare providers will be immune from liability if they fail to diagnose your appendicitis based on the wording of that statute. It's now you have to prove, once you get through hoops, you have to prove gross negligence, which is impossible.
Right. And they basically tried to kill him, you know?
Right. And you have to, before that, even argue that they were acting in bad faith, which, listen, there's a lot of bad medicine, but to me personally, a lot of them are not acting in bad faith. They're making a big mistake, but not acting in bad faith, not acting grossly negligent. That's not where most of the cases I ever see. It's a negligent mistake, a medical mistake, a medical error that caused an injury. So you're never going to get through those hoops. And that's going to cut out a lot of cases. I have a case now that I don't think has anything to do with COVID, but we roundtabled it among many lawyers, and the person's brain damaged at 52 years old. And that case is going to be dropped because the healthcare provider is going to have immunity on the medical care and treatment.
I agree with you. And you sort of said it, because you offered this blanket immunity, but the way we talked about with medical malpractice anyway, you have to have an affidavit from an expert that says they were below the standard of care. And I think particularly early on, and I think the healthcare providers did an amazing job of dealing with this, but I don't think there was a standard of care. So I don't think you'd be able to find experts to say that these COVID related issues, you know, were below the standard of care, because who's going to define that? But everything else, as with every other business, medicine went on just like other businesses went on.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, the fact that you've sort of blanket immunity, everything
blanket. Yeah,
is sort of a difficult problem. But, and I agree with you, you know, you talk about doctors, and I get a lot of times, you know, oh, I don't want to sue my doctor. But I say, but if you hired an architect and the back, you know, portion of your roof collapsed, I'd sue them.
Yeah.
But it's the same thing. They're a professional. So no, it's not an issue that they have to be in bad faith or they are mm-hmm. intending this, or, because you're right, the vast, vast majority of cases aren't that.
Yeah.
But they're professionals. They need to be held to standards. You put your trust in them, and you should be able to rely on that.
Yeah. And I have a lot of friends, my good, close friends are doctors. And if they asked me to help them look at a case where they're sued, and I firmly believe they did nothing wrong, I would help them just like I'll help the patient. We just can't have frivolous lawsuits. We have to have meaningful, just lawsuits. And if my friend made a mistake and I looked at the case and said, I determined you made a mistake, I'd say, hey, man, you made a mistake. You got to take care of this issue and then let the family move on and you move on. It was a mistake. No one's saying you did anything intentionally. And on the patient side, I would say, listen, the doctor was wrong. He shouldn't have done that, and he caused you significant injury. I'll represent you and take care of that. So I just want to make sure that I'm looking to make sure that there's no frivolous lawsuits out there, because we'll get back to killing all the lawyers. And that's probably where that comes from for taking on ridiculous things. And that's the, a lot of the times that that's the stuff that gets put in the newspaper.
It does.
And,
I mean,
that's the unfortunate part of the, when people are looking on lawyers to see what type of profession it is.
Yeah. And you get a lot of that because that's what they see. They see the McDonald's cases and that's what they want to set the standards at. Yeah. And, well, it was horrible liability in that too, but
yeah,
but you know, that's what's perceived. So you're right. And, but I think, and I, young lawyers I work with, students I work with and whatnot, I said, you know, obviously lawyers get a bad reputation at times. I said, but that's up to you to control. The reputation you have, you know, Jim Nosich isn't going to file some frivolous lawsuit, you know, to get his name in a headline somewhere. You control that. So control your own reputation. And then, yeah, maybe Shakespeare was wrong and they shouldn't kill all the lawyers.
Was did Shakespeare mean one of the lawyers that caused a sticker to go on a lawnmower that says, don't use it to cut hedges?
Right.
So that'd be all the kill the lawyers lawyer.
Yeah, that and, you know, cruise controls and motorhomes, you know.
Good point.
10 years ago.
Yeah.
We're not talking not Tesla auto idea. Driving. Yeah. You can't go make a cup idea. Of coffee while you're in the RV. Going, yeah. I put it on cruise control. Yeah,
not a good idea.
No, no. There's a balance in there somewhere else. So what else in your practice did you see? A slowdown in the practice? How is your practice coming back and evolving?
I think it wasn't a slowdown of new cases coming in and reviewing the cases. It was a slow process of resolving cases.
Right.
So as I tell every client, we want to always, you want to try to get the case resolved to get the stress off you and least amount of costs. But when there's no pressure on either side, my side to put the risk of trial on me, or on the other side to put the risk of a jury verdict on them, that slows the system down and you can't resolve cases and you can't help your clients out. And you have to tell them, look, if the other side doesn't want to resolve the case, we might be in this thing 3-4 years.
Right.
And that's the honest truth. And that's what you have to be, always be honest, obviously, with the client. So you try to explain all that. And I think that made us more selective on cases because you wanted to tell the client and get you a quicker resolution, I think, based on the facts of your case versus something that's going to be around 3-5 years from now, which makes it then harder and harder to resolve as the case goes on. And you end up with a jury verdict, which how great it is. Also, listen, it's now out of your control. It's out of the judge's control. It's out of the other attorney's control. It's in the control of six people you never met before. And that's the beauty of the process. And that's the not so beautiful part of the process, but it's the end result. And that takes time to get there. And especially when there's a pandemic going on, you're talking a long time from now, which is not that good for the client on either side.
No. And the other aspect, if you've got to wait, you know, another 3 years or so for the jury trial, that's not necessarily the end. Things go very well for you or things go bad for you.
Sure.
Then you've got the appellate courts.
Forgot all about that, but that's 100% correct. And I had a case where I have some big photo boards in my office. I show the client that says, look at this case. And they go, oh my God, did you win? Did you lose that? And I go, no, I won it. They go, oh, that's great. I go, no, because then the trial judge took the verdict away. They go, what? They can do that? I go, yeah, yep. I didn't know that really in that particular case. And then we went to the appellate court. And then, so that took 3 more years. And then the result was you have to try the case over again. And that was a 2-month trial. So, and that changes all the dynamics. So, you know, you want to resolve your case as quickly as possible for all different kinds of reasons that your lawyer can explain. And it's probably in your best interest always to keep you have control of what the end result is. And maybe it's not the most perfect result. Maybe it's a great result, but you still maintain control and take out all the other risk of maybe getting nothing at the end of the day.
Well said. Well said. So We talk about the difficulty in sort of establishing and proving a medical malpractice case. So what advice do you have just to the general public who says, well, how do I know whether I've got a medical malpractice case?
All right. If you think you have a medical malpractice case, and most people think they get that feeling from, unfortunately, the lack of communication from their physicians, or they're like, nah, this isn't the result that's supposed to happen. Or it's so obvious that because you were in the hospital or you were in the doctor's office or it's you and you know what was being said then versus now.
Or it's the friend in New York who's a lawyer who says, oh, that's a multimillion dollar case.
Oh, you know that guy too?
This is a slam dunk and
And you'll get a lot of times the nurses will go, oh my God, I can't believe the doctor did that to you. I can't believe the doctors. I can't believe the nurses did that. Usually they don't end up testifying to that at the end of the day, but
it's amazing how that works out.
Yeah. But you need to get a lawyer who's competent in medical malpractice, who's going to be committed to you, that will know your case. And you don't want someone who drags the case on, doesn't return your phone calls, lack of communication. You want someone that's on top of it, quick, decisive, and then puts the ball in your court at the end of the day for you to make the decision, but with the right information. That's who you need to get. A lot of times also you might have a great case, but in Florida, there's no law requiring medical malpractice insurance. And so you might have a lawyer that says, you have a great case, but I can't take it because there's no medical malpractice insurance. And then you have to explain that whole system. And it might seem that, this is what I tell the client, it might seem like it's unfair, which it is, but unfair that the lawyer won't take your case because there's no insurance. But at the end of the day, the lawyer can only bring you money.
Right.
More likely than not, there's not going to be changes of policies, or the doctor's going to act a different way, or the hospital is going to change something. We can only give you money. And if we can't do that, there's no reason to take the case. And that's just the unfortunate luck of that situation with that physician or healthcare provider that doesn't carry medical malpractice insurance. And there's a lot of nuances to that, but the important part is if they have insurance on the front end, you have more of an opportunity to resolve a case than if a physician has no insurance. And that whole process of trying to get money from someone that doesn't have enough money or protected money to give to your client.
Well, that's the harsh reality, and you're right. That money's always protected. If that doctor's bare, he's not going to have collectible assets or anything else. And that is one of the hard conversations to have with clients. They want the pound of flesh. They want justice. They want the doctor to lose his license. And you're right. Absent some extraordinarily egregious things, which just aren't there in most cases. Because again, it's not an intentional act. It's not, but then telling them, well, you have a case, we can't go forward, because you won't get any money at the end of the day. We can't get paid at the end of the day. And it's a tough, tough thing to sell to a client or to tell the client.
Yeah, it's very tough. They don't understand it. They might look on the internet and see where there is a requirement to have at least $250,000. But if you read that black and white, it's not really what it means. It means way at the end of the day, if you go get a verdict and you go chase that money down, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, 3, 4, 5 years later, medical malpractice cases, the lawyer tries to be selective because they're very expensive, between $75,000, sometimes $250,000, $300,000 or more, or way more, depending on the complicated nature of the case. So you got to be very selective in the cases, because ultimately the client's got to pay for the costs, which you want money at the end of the day to be there so they can do that.
Particularly those cases that go to verdict, get taken away, that go up on appeal, that get retried, and those things you have no control over.
No control.
Because, trying to have a perfect trial where every ruling, is unquestionable, just doesn't happen. There's too many moving parts in there. Somebody's going to have some basis to at least get an appellate court to take a look at it.
Well, in my case, they waived all issues that that I acted improperly in the trial, waived it all, and just said the verdict was unfair. And I
that's waiving
know.
A lot of issues about you being appropriate in trial.
I agree. You know. I agree. But I never, even in my experience, I'm like, I go to my appellate lawyer, I go, we won this. Judge took it away because it was unfair. We sat here for 2 months, and he goes, no, they can do that. And you only have a 50% chance of winning that. I'm like, what? And that was enlightening to me. You learn something new every day. And I was like, are you kidding me? I mean, it was a clean trial. They're waiving everything. I didn't do any error. And it was just against the manifest weight of the evidence. It ended up where the jury foreman read that order and wrote an editorial or an opinion piece to the newspaper going, what is the judge talking about? You know, we sat here for 2 months, listened every day. Right. We deliberated for 3 days. No one tricked us. We listened. I don't know what you're saying. And then it went on for another 3 years after 4 years. So
it is surprising that they do have that power. And you think, well, wait a minute. Now you're just substituting yourself for the six jurors. Why didn't we just have a bench trial if that's the way it was going to go?
Well, that's because you and I are an appellate lawyer.
That's true. That's true.
We're just in the trenches,
We need smarter people than us to be appellate lawyers.
Definitely.
All right. Listen, Jim, it has been an absolute pleasure.
My pleasure.
Always like seeing you. Always like talking to you, you know, legal and otherwise. And look forward to working on some cases with you as we continue on. I want to thank Grant Miller and Community Newspapers for giving us this platform, and our producer, Tommy, for making us all try to look good and put it all together. And we'll be back next week. I think I might drag my law partner in here, Mark Kerr, to talk about changes in automobile insurance law, because it looks like that's going to go through, and that's going to be a pretty big sweeping change. So we'll educate you on where that is. And until then, everybody have a great week.